Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests, and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now, here's Bruce Ash.
Today we're talking about the U.S. manned space program on the 50th anniversary of Eagle's landing on the moon.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Projects Gemini and Apollo. Our very special guest is retired Air Force General, Korean War fighter pilot, test pilot, Gemini 4 commander, and Apollo 9 commander, James McDivitt. His space flights both achieved milestones, Gemini 4 with Ed White's first American EVA, and Apollo 9 joined by fellow astronauts David Scott and Rusty Schweikert, who during their 10-day mission tested many systems and procedures critical to going to the moon, including firing the LEM engine, plus testing the navigational and rendezvous systems for maneuvers to make that trip. Adding to his manned spaceflight experience, McDivitt also served as manager of lunar operations and led a team that planned the lunar exploration program. In 1969, he became manager of the Apollo spacecraft program and was program manager for Apollos 12 through 16. General McDivitt has logged over 3,500 jet flight hours and nearly 340 hours in space. Welcome to Inside Track. Honored to join up with us today, sir.
Thank you very much. That's quite an introduction. I'm going to have to look back and see if I really did that.
I think you did. I read about it in Wikipedia.
It's got to be true.
Jim, I understand that you received your Air Force commission and your pilot wings at Williams Field here in Arizona. What are your recollections of your days at Willie?
It was very heady. I went through pilot training in 1951-52, and that was the early days of the jet flying stuff. And the only place they taught it back in those days was at Willie. So going to Willie was like a feather in your hat, and it was, you know, where all the guys wanted to go. I got to go there, so it was really a great time.
Did you ever fly into Davis-Monthan here in Tucson?
I don't know. I know I flew over it a lot because there was one time, 20 years after I started flying, I was flying across Tucson in a T-33, and I thought, you know, I don't think I made much progress. 20 years ago, I was flying over this area in a T-33. I didn't make much progress very fast anyway.
Well, you should have stopped and got either a Sonoran hot dog or a nice taco, but you do spend some time out here in Tucson during the year, so we're happy to call you one of our own. Jim, in 1962, you were part of Astronaut Group 2. Did you apply or were you recommended for consideration? And how difficult was the selection process for this group?
Well, it was kind of an interesting trip for me. Most of the guys applied and went through a selection process. I was not interested in space in those days. And my boss called me in one day and said, Jim, we're sending you off to France to test fly a bunch of airplanes. And during that period of time, would you like to have us submit you for the next astronaut selection? And I said, no, I'm not interested in that. I want to stay here and fly airplanes. So I went off and did my things in France, came home 6 weeks later or so, and started getting ready to fly the X-15, which I'd been assigned to when my conscience got the better of me. The Air Force sent me to the University of Michigan, the Test Pilot School, the Aerospace Research Pilot School, and all that stuff. And I thought, well, maybe I should not do what I want, but maybe I should do what I ought to do. So late at night, I called a guy who was the X-15 pilot. Bob White was his name.
Yeah.
And I said, Bob, I want to talk to you, because I knew he had recommended me for the X-15. So I went down to his house. We had a couple beers, talked it all over, and he said, you know, if you think you ought to do that, then you ought to do it. And so he says, I'll meet you down at the office at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I called Washington to see if they'll accept your application. It's like 2 months late. So we met, they called, and they said, yeah, they accepted it, but we needed it right away. So Bob White typed up my application, and I took it over colonel assigned, and that's how I got in. A little bit late, but still made it.
And how difficult was the selection process that you had to go through?
Well, you know, as one of the processes, it didn't seem that tough. You know, we had to take a physical and do some interviews and stuff like that, but it didn't seem to be that tough.
Well, obviously, you were a pretty good pilot, but with all the great pilots in America in the early 60s, why do you think you were selected?
Because I was the greatest pilot in 1960.
There you go. So that actually, Jim, that actually leads me to my next question. You know, popular culture, some movies that I'm sure, you know, most people have seen, maybe you didn't, but they portray the early astronauts as hard drivers. Do you think that's accurate? And were you considered a hard driver?
Well, I think the Mercury 7 group was a lot different than our group of nine. I was in the second group. I think the first guys, I'm not sure how they were selected, but our group of nine was based upon flying skills and intelligence and dedication and a whole bunch of stuff like that. So we were, if you want to say, hard drivers, did we work hard at getting in, and did we work hard when we got in? Yes, we were hard drivers. But we didn't have all the, you know, it wasn't like scarfers flying in the wind and your goggles were getting steamy. It wasn't quite like that. It, you know, being an astronaut, hard work. And it takes a lot of studying, and you do a lot of dangerous things. So it's not like you walk in off the street and do that stuff.
And of course, you had experienced educational background in engineering that probably well suited you for this type of advanced work as well, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, it did. No, I went to the University of Michigan, got a degree in aeronautical engineering, and space is a little bit different than aeronautics, but that same course today is called Space and Aeronautics. Yeah, your education was important, I thought. When I joined, and the longer I was in, the more I realized that it was. When I went on from being an astronaut up to being a program manager, I was making decisions on parachutes, hypergolic fuels, landing impacts, and, you know, all this stuff. But it was good common sense and a lot of help from the rest of the team.
Jim, you flew with a guy by the name of Ed White on Gemini 4, a very historic flight with his EVA and with some of the other work that you guys did with Rendezvous. Ed, of course, died in the Apollo 1 fire. What are your recollections of your time training and flying with Ed White?
Well, Ed and I had a long history. He was at the University of Michigan. When I was there, he was getting a master's degree in aeronautical engineering. I was getting a bachelor's. But since he was a West Point graduate, he didn't have all the undergraduate courses in aero. And so we took a lot of classes together. He lived on the same street I did in Ann Arbor. And we were both Air Force pilots, so we continued to do our flying, and we flew a lot together. We went from University of Michigan to the test pilot school, and we're in the same class. When we graduated, I stayed at Edwards, and he went to Wright-Patterson. So we had a long history together, and when I walked into the room of applicants for astronaut training that the Air Force was doing to screen us, he says to me, "I knew you'd be there." And I said the same thing to him. I knew you'd be here. Yeah, we were in a very unique relationship. I could almost tell what he was thinking.
So you were a rookie astronaut flying as commander on Gemini 4 with White. I've been up close to a Gemini vehicle. You and Captain White did 66 orbits, 4 days in that spacecraft. Did you ever feel claustrophobic?
Yeah, I wouldn't say we were claustrophobic, but we got tired of being cramped up like that. I'll tell you, the guys that really did well are Borman and Lovell. They spent 14 days in that Lulu B thing, and I That was a long time.
Before we take a break, two questions real quick. The objective of Gemini 4 mission was rendezvous. Reports were rendezvous was difficult during your mission to achieve when you're on that trip. What lessons were learned from Gemini 4 that helped further rendezvous and docking capability, which was really the key to getting to the moon?
Yeah, well, first, your premises is wrong. There was never any intention to do a rendezvous on Gemini 4.
Oh.
What we were going to do is we were going to go up, get launched, get in the orbit, separate from the rocket, turn the spacecraft around, and Ed was going to go back and take a piece of metal off the rocket. Well, the timeline was such that we couldn't get that done. It was just too much to do all at once. And so I just tried to fly formation with it and through the darkness. And then when we came out on the other side, it was just not possible to do what we were planning on doing. We made a mistake. And we put two strobe lights on the rocket so that we could see it in the dark. Well, if you look at a cylinder and you put a light on either side of it, how many lights can you see at one time? The answer is one, not two, because you can only see two lights if the vehicle is oriented exactly correctly. So we didn't have the right kind of equipment to do that, and it was never intended to be a rendezvous.
Well, Wikipedia had that one wrong. General.
Everybody said, well, you didn't do the rendezvous. We never had any intention of doing a rendezvous.
Well, so that information is going to be out for everybody to know. General, let's take a quick break for some messages from our great sponsors. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside Track. Welcome back to Inside Track, our final segment with an American hero, former Gemini and Apollo astronaut James McDivitt. After the Apollo 1 fire and resulting safety review, there was a lot of mission crew shifting. Jim, is it accurate that after your Apollo 9 crew had been selected, you were also offered to ride instead on Apollo 8 to orbit the moon, but you turned that down to fly on 9?
Yeah, I don't like the way you phrased that, offered a ride. Our whole crew were shifted over.
Ah.
But yes, indeed, we were offered that, and I did turn it down. And the reason for that was it was going to be a big publicity deal, and we would have all been heroes, but the fact that I was in the program was we were trying to get to the moon in that decade, and the long pole in the tent was the lunar module. It wasn't going as fast as we had hoped. The first lunar module that we were testing was lunar module 2. It had so many electrical problems with it that we decided not to fly that, and we had to wait till lunar module 3 was built and tested, and since it was the long pole in the tent getting to the moon in that decade, I felt that it was more my responsibility to get that part of it done than it was to get the publicity of going to the moon on orbit. So that sounds kind of nutty today, but that's the way I felt.
No, but it makes sense. There, I guess there was a book written about the Apollo program, and this book said McDivitt's crew was amongst the best trained ever. They had worked together since January 1966, and you know that had to be crucial to your success when you did go up on 9, don't you think?
Oh yeah, you know we were the backup crew for Apollo 1, and we left just before the thing burned up, and so we spent some very excruciating time testing that vehicle and getting ready for the first flight and stuff. So we had that. And then the astronauts always tested the spacecraft. So after we were assigned to fly up the first version of Apollo 9, we tested the command module and we're working on a lunar module when they inserted the Apollo 8 mission. So we tested the Apollo 1 spacecraft command module, the same thing with the Apollo 8 command module, and the Apollo 9 commander. We could have built that thing by ourselves without blueprints.
Yeah,
but I thought that if we were going to get to the moon in that time. There wasn't enough time to change crews and still get Apollo 9 off at any time. You know, we flew it in March.
March 3rd.
69, and they, yeah, and they landed in July. If we had delayed that 6 months,
yeah,
probably would have been in 1970.
That was the reason. So, Jim, Apollo 9 was a very important low-Earth orbital flight, the first one powered by the big Saturn V rocket. What was the launch ride like riding on top of the Saturn versus the Titan that you'd gone up in not too many years before when you went up on that flight March 3rd, 1969?
Well, believe it or not, while the Titan was a lot smaller, the G-load on that flight was a lot higher. As I recall... We were about 6 G's when we burned out on the first stage, and we're at 8.5 when we were into orbit. On Apollo, it was like a 1.25, 1.5, 2 G's on the first stage, something like 4 on the second stage, and the third stage was like 1.5 or something. The big thing was that the rocket made so much noise that, the acoustic pounding on the command module was quite noticeable, to say the least. And as we launched, as soon as we went supersonic, the acoustic vibrations from the engines couldn't reach the command module. So when we went supersonic, we were faster than the speed of sound. So all that noise from the engines didn't affect us anymore.
You might remember the HBO movie From the Earth to the Moon. They showed the original Apollo 9 LEM had some problems and was replaced. You spoke about that before. The call sign for the LEM that you tested out was Spider. How was Spider to fly?
It was great. We were just exactly the way we thought it would. And we had done a lot of simulator training, but that's not exactly like actually doing it. But it was a very good spacecraft. Yeah, it could have been better. Mm. You know, Apollo Lunar Module 2, LEM 2 is in the Smithsonian in Washington, and it would be worth a lot for people to go look at it, because all the models I saw of the lunar module had hard sides and stuff like that. But the actual spacecraft, because it never flew in the atmosphere, had a very flimsy external. It was cellophane, mylar, put together with staples and Scotch tape. So it looks pretty flimsy. And of course it was.
So I guess maybe it was still like flying old biplanes with cloth wings and so on.
Well, fortunately, the interior of it was airtight. And yeah, it was made out of, I believe, titanium, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Jim, would you mind taking on a little more time? I know I hadn't talked with you about doing three segments, but I'm having fun. If you're having fun, we'll continue this in just a second. We're going to take these few breaks for commercials. We'll be right back with Jim McDivitt. You're listening to Inside Track. Welcome back to Inside Track, here for our last segment with Jim McDivitt. Jim, your crew fired the big SPS engines during your Apollo 9 flight, testing the engine's performance and reliability. That was a pretty big deal for you, wasn't it?
That's right. You know, the lunar module had two stages, the landing stage and the descent stage. The landing stage engine was a throttleable rocket, and throttleable rockets were not. There weren't very many throttleable rockets in those days. So just having a rocket that you could throttle was really important. So we ran it through all the paces up and down and off and on and all that. And the ascent stage engine was a fixed thrust engine, but it's right in the cockpit with you. So we sat on it when we weren't doing any other things. So, those engine tests were extremely important.
I have a goofy question for you. There are lots of stories about things that astronauts smuggled on board their flights. Now, without getting anybody in trouble, and certainly not you, but was anything ever smuggled on board during any of your flights?
No. We didn't do that stuff.
No corned beef sandwiches?
No, I was going to say there was a corned beef sandwich problem with Gemini 3, and that was a very dangerous thing to do. Oxygen grease, oxygen and grease don't go well together. And the slightest spark will ignite it. So you don't want to put a flammable thing like that in the spacecraft, because we found out when Apollo burned, one burned up, that you don't want to do that.
Sure. David Scott and Rusty Schweikert did an extensive EVA on Apollo 9, and despite a nausea problem that Schweikert suffered during the flight, what was the major goal of their EVA?
Well, there were really three spacecraft that were going off to the moon. The command and service module, the lunar module, and the backpack that the guys wore on the moon. And so we had to test that in an environment as close to the lunar environment as we could get. And of course, that's a vacuum. And Rusty put that on and went outside and did what he needed to do to make sure that that thing worked. And so that was a very important test of the whole thing.
He had some problems with nausea, and I guess he was never able to fly again after Apollo 9.
No, I think he could have flown. Yeah, he had some problem with nausea, but, you know, so did a lot of other guys. Frank Borman did, and motion sickness is not a rare disease. And after a while, they gave all the guys Dramamine or something like that before launch, so they didn't get sick. And when Rusty threw up, you know, it's very dangerous in zero-G, especially if you're inside a pressurized suit.
Sure.
Because that stuff doesn't fall on the floor. There's no gravity, so it just hangs right where it is. And if you're inside of a pressurized helmet, you could suffocate with that stuff hanging around in front of your nose and mouth. So, anyway, when he threw up, and the next day when we were going to, and I was going to do the EVA then, and the next day when he was, we were getting ready to do the EVA, I asked him how he felt, and I was watching him, and after a while I thought, well, you know, he can do this, I don't need to do it, he can do it. So we did, and it was great, he did a good job.
On the fifth day of the Apollo 9 mission, the key event of probably the entire flight took place, so that was separation and rendezvous of the LEN with the command module. That was a big deal, don't you think?
That was a big deal. Because once we got out there, we had to get back.
So there's two men in the LEM. So how does that work? Who's driving it, and who's keeping an eye on instruments and watching out the window and so on?
We did it together. You know, we'd been together for years, training together, and we knew what we were supposed to do. You know, you fly the lunar module standing up. You don't sit down, you stand up.
Right.
And to keep you from floating around, we had bungee cords, those great big rubber bands that we hooked to our suits and to the floor. So we were standing there, and it was just like, you know, no different than Gemini 4 or flying in the command module. We each had a job to do, and we did it. Rusty did a good job.
And you know, that's really sort of the secret of the space program, and even in warfare. There are so many people that have all of these specific jobs that have to be done to get the big job, to get to the big goal. But this one, separation, rendezvous, and docking, that was huge. Because without this, we wouldn't have... I mean, that was the key to going to the moon. I mean, after we figured out the physics and the wherewithal to get everybody together to be in a place where you did rendezvous, you know, you still had to be able to do it, and you guys did it. And the success of your mission led to quick succession to Apollo 10, which navigated the LEM with the LEM to orbit around the moon. And then in July 69, the crew of Apollo 11 landed on the moon. As you look back on your flight, what do you think the most important thing that your flight proved, being able to get back and forth to the moon before 1970?
As I mentioned earlier, I thought the long pole in the tent to get to the moon in a decade was the lunar module. And Rusty and I had been working on that thing. Another guy named Fred Hayes had been working on that lunar module for a long time, including the lunar module 2, when we finally decided we couldn't fly it. It wasn't safe because of the electrical problems. So it had to get done. And that's one of the reasons that when we were offered a chance to go to the run of the moon on Apollo 8, I said we'd better or say with Apollo 9, or we're not going to get to the moon on time.
Yeah.
Because to switch crews and try to catch up and get that thing launched when we needed to was a major problem.
So you never were able to fly to the moon or land there, but you were in charge of lunar operations for 5 lunar missions. Can you describe what that job was like and your continued contributions to Apollo? Because, I mean, this is the blocking and tackling of what you guys did, the behind-the-scenes stuff that made it happen.
I'd left the space, the Astron program, and I was working in the Apollo spacecraft program. And I knew I was going to take over the program after we landed on the moon. And I was down at the Cape with Air Force Three-Star General, who was the program director. And he said to me, Jim, we're getting ready to do the landing, but we haven't got an exploration program. So I said, I think you better get on that. So I took a bunch of guys, and we worked for about 2 or 3 months and redid how we were going to explore the moon. We added things like the rover to it, made the lunar module last longer on the surface and all that stuff. So before I took over the program, we had two kinds of missions. One were about 11, 12, 13, and 14. And then 15, 16, and 17 had the new equipment, had the rover in them. And they could stay on the moon for 3 days and stuff. So it was a very exciting time trying to figure all that stuff out.
So you worked with a lot of pretty smart people.
Did I ever?
And sir, you're a pretty smart guy yourself. Who, in your experience, who is the smartest guy that you ever worked with?
Come on, I'm better, Bruce. If I said somebody else, that would be a dollar for me.
Okay, then who, Jim? Then who was the next? Who was the next smartest guy?
Bruce, wait a second. Who's the smartest interviewer on radio?
It ain't me.
Oh, come on.
So all kidding aside, who was the second smartest guy that you ever met in the space program?
I'm thinking. I won't tell you the names. I one time was asked to categorize the astronauts. Who was the best, who was the worst, and all that stuff. And I had a couple guys in the best, one guy in the worst, and all the rest of them were really good. And that's, I'm not going to mention any names.
So we're going to take these few breaks for commercials. We'll be right back with Jim McDivitt. You're listening to Inside Track. Welcome back to Inside Track, our final segment with an American hero, former Gemini and Apollo astronaut James McDivitt. So, Jim, what do you think about the hoopla and the nostalgia at the 50th anniversary with Apollo and NASA? Is this going someplace? I mean, is the nostalgia going to lead to more manned space exploration, do you think?
I don't know. I'm not much on this nostalgia stuff. We had the 50th anniversary of Apollo 9 recently in San Diego, where our spacecraft is. It was a very nice event, very nice event put on by this San Diego Air and Space Museum. But, we ought to spend more time saying about where we're going. And quite frankly, I'm not sure if we know what we're doing. Because, when I got into spacecraft flying business, we knew what we were going to do. We're going to go to the moon. And so all the time I was in NASA, we knew what our goal was. But since I've gotten out, we had all kinds of goals. And I just saw recently we're going to go back to the moon in 2024. That 2024 just so happens to be the end of President Trump's second term, if he's. And so, we pull these things out of our ears, I think. And we talk about going to Mars. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that anybody's thought that through. During Apollo, when they had the guys in deep space, they were getting white flashes in their eyes. And so I put together an experiment where we put metal plates over the windows of the command module, and they sat down in the lower equipment bay where most of the equipment was. I had a helmet made with two visors. One visor fixed, the other visor movable. And so when we said mark, we turned the mortar on and moved the movable one. And whenever they saw a white flash, they'd go mark, and we'd have the time. So we could bring that helmet back to Earth and reenact this thing. So whenever they said mark, we could look for pinholes in the visor, and we could see where that high energy particle that was coming right through the spacecraft was going, and it was impinging on the optical nerve of the astronauts. Well, if one particle came through and impinged on that nerve, there were a lot of other particles coming in and impinging on their brains, and this only happened in deep space. So I don't know how people are going to get to Mars and still have any intelligence when they get there. If we spend 2 years out in deep space getting impinged by higher energy particles, I don't hear anybody talking about that stuff.
No, that's the first time I've ever heard that, and I follow this pretty carefully, as careful as any civilian can. That is a troubling sort of a thing to hear. There's a greater importance to getting to the moon and back than just getting there. I mean, so many different things, technological things happen as a result of Apollo. Do you think in the overall scheme of things, I mean, has the $100 or $120 billion we've spent over a period of time, has it been worth it, do you think? I mean, would we do it all over again if we had that opportunity?
Depends on the time. There were two things. I think there still are two things to be gained by spaceflight. One is national prestige, and the other is scientific stuff. Now, how much is national prestige worth? How much is the science worth? Well, I don't have an answer for that. But I would say that the Apollo program, the national prestige was extremely important.
Yeah.
And you know, there's no science that's ever done on the moon. You can't do science on the moon. You grab a rock and bring it back, and they analyze it on Earth. And I was pressured, or we were pressured, to have a scientists fly on a lunar landing mission.
Right, Harrison Schmitt.
Jack Schmitt,
yeah.
Who was a geologist, flew on the mission. Jack didn't do anything that all the other guys didn't do. He just picked up rocks, because we'd all been trained in geology a little. And so you had to bring that stuff back. And so the idea of putting a permanent station on the moon, the logistics of that are mind-boggling. I can't imagine how you do that. I don't think there's enough money in the world to do that. But that, you know, we're going to do it, so the president says.
Well, you know, there's probably as much power in the telephone that I'm recording this interview in that I understand was on your onboard computers on the Apollo flight. So for that alone, I'm grateful. And I thank you, sir, for joining us today in celebration of your accomplishments and those of all the men and women of NASA, all the engineers, each of the contractors, the smart scientists, and all of the Americans who shared the dream of rising from the sands of Kitty Hawk to the Sea of Tranquility, all within 66 years. And hopefully, as I dream about these things, eventually back to the moon and beyond. Sir, I stand in great admiration of your personal accomplishments and your bravery, and thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Bruce. Remember, you're number one.
Yeah, and you bet.
Inside Track now presents the liftoff sequence, compressed a good bit, on 50 years ago this very day today, July 20th, 1969. First the liftoff sequence, and then the landing sequence as Apollo 11 lands on the moon.
564 is verified. Okay, the swing arm is going to full retract at this time.
Okay, all flight controllers coming up on auto sequence. Booster, how are you?
We're go flight.
Go flight.
TNT?
Go flight.
Telcom? Go flight. Control?
Go.
Network, you got it all? Got it all? Everything up?
That's affirmative, flight.
Apollo 11, this is the Launch Operations Manager. The launch team wishes you good luck and Godspeed.
Thank you very much. No, it'll be a good one. All right, CDR, FTC, how do you read me?
FTC, loud and clear.
Okay, Neil, have a good one.
Okay.
All right, CMP on panel 2, disk, you verify program 2.
Program 2.
Start sequence.
Auto sequence, flight.
Roger. KL flight controllers, wind auto sequence, stand by.
AB, proceed.
S2, pre-press complete flight.
Roger.
30 seconds.
GRR. Roger, GRR.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, ignition. Lift off.
Roger, clock.
Clock start flight, roger. Thrusters go, all engines, roger.
Clear the tire. Roger, we got a roll program.
Flight fighter,
roger, roll.
Roger, IP.
Flight range safety is nominal.
Roger, R, sir.
Roll is complete and the pitch is programmed.
Roger, roll, roger, pitch. Stand by for one Bravo. Mark, one Bravo.
One Bravo.
Our flight range safety is off in the water.
Roger, R, sir.
Roger.
Okay.
Captain, we're leaving.
Roger, how are you, Booster?
We're going to flight.
Good at 1 minute, Captain.
Oh, 11 Houston, you're good at 1 minute.
Roger. Fido flight, how are you?
Looking good, flight.
GNC?
Looks good, flight.
Ecom?
Looking good, flight.
Roger. Booster flight, how are you?
We're going to flight.
Surgeon?
We're go flight.
Everything's good.
Roger. Stand by for mode 1, Charlie.
Stand by for mode 1, Charlie.
Mark,
mode 1, Charlie.
Staging, starting booster.
Go.
Fido.
Go.
Guidance.
Go.
Good for staging, Captain.
Apollo 11, this is Houston. You are go for staging.
Inboard cutoff.
We confirm inboard cutoff.
Confirm inboard. Roger. IUE, Com.
Or go flight.
GNC.
Or go flight.
Roger.
Staging. And ignition.
Cutoff, ignition.
Roger.
Trajectory verified.
Thrusters go all engines.
Looks good, Captain.
11 Houston, thrusters go all engines. You're looking good.
All right, Roger. You're loud and clear, Houston. We got the first step.
Roger, we confirm.
Confirm second step. Plane step.
Roger.
Tower's gone.
Roger, tower's gone, Fido.
Houston, be advised, the visual is go today.
This is Houston. Roger, out.
Let me know when it converges, guys.
Yeah, they finally gave me a window to look out.
Looks good, flight converged. Steering converged, Captain.
11 Houston, your guidance is converged. You're looking good.
How are you, Booster?
We're go flight.
GNC?
We're go flight.
Sergeant?
Go flight.
We're good at 4 minutes, Captain.
11 Houston, you are go at 4 minutes.
Roger.
11 Houston, you are go at 5 minutes.
Roger, you. 11, go.
Stand by for S4B to COI capability.
Stand by
for
S4B to COI capability.
Okay.
Mark.
Mark, S4B to COI capability.
Roger. You sure sound clear down here, Bruce. I think you're sitting in your living room.
Oh, thank you. You all are coming through beautifully, too.
Booster flight, how are you?
We're go flight.
GNC?
We're go flight.
Econ?
Go flight.
Guidance?
We're go flight.
We're go.
Okay.
Flight fighter, they all look good. We're go.
Roger.
We're go at 6 minutes, starting to get
warm. So are we.
Roger, 11, you're go from the ground at 6 minutes.
Flight booster,
go.
Times, 8 plus 1, 7, 9 plus 1, 1. Copy, 8, 1, 7, 9, 1, 1.
Roger.
Gimbal's on.
Roger, gimbal.
Apollo 11, this is Houston. Level sense arm at 8 plus 1, 7. Outboard cutoff at 9 plus 1, 1.
Good at 7 minutes, Captain.
Apollo 11, good at 7 minutes.
11, this is Houston. Roger, your go from the ground at 7 minutes. Level sense arm at 8 plus 1, 7. Outboard cutoff at 9 plus 1, 1.
Roger.
Apollo 11, this is Houston. Vanguard LOS at 1535. AOS Canaries at 1630. Over.
Okay, thank you.
CVTS flight.
Go flight.
We're in anomal orbit here, as we can tell. Everything working just fine. Cliff sends his regards. I'm sure three other guys do, too.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your good support.
Our pleasure.
Who's gonna go for landing? Retro. Go, Ido. Go. Guidance. Go. Control. Go. Capcom. Go. GNC. Go. Ecom. Go. Surgeon. Go. Capcom. We're go for landing.
Eagle Houston, you're go for landing. Over.
I do understand. Go for landing. 3,000 feet. Capcom. 1201.
Bravo 1.
Roger, 1201.
Same type, we're go, flight. Okay, we're go.
We're go, same type, we're go.
Flight side of right on, real good.
2,000 feet, into the ag, 47 degrees.
Roger.
3,000 feet. American looking, Bob. It looks okay, we've got 4.5. Roger.
Eagle looking great, you're go.
Altitude up 8 next. Looks good.
Roger.
Roger, 1202, we copy it.
How you doing, Control?
We look
good here, fine. Right, how about you, top down? Go, guide you, go, fight out, go.
700 feet, 21 down, 33 degrees. 100 feet, down at 19. 540 feet, down at 30, down at 15.
Attitude home? Okay, at hold.
I think we better be quiet, fine.
Right. 400 feet, down at 9.
Okay, the only call-outs from now on will be fuel.
Straight forward. 10 and 50 feet down at 4.
P-66.
30, strip the half down. They're pegged on the horizontal velocity. 10 and feet down 3.5. 47 forward. Hold up. And 1.5 down. 70. Down at 2.5. 19 forward.
Okay, Bob, I'll be standing by for your call out shortly.
3.5 down. 220 feet. 15 forward. 11 forward. Come down nicely. 200 feet. 4.5 down. 5.5 down. 166. 6.5 down. 5.5 down. 9 forward.
Low level. Low level.
Good. 220 feet. 100 feet, 3.5 down, 9 forward. 5%. 75. 75 feet. There's a good 60, down and a half.
60 seconds.
60 seconds.
Lights on. Down 2.5. Forward. Forward. 30 feet down, 2.5. Picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down. Take saddle.
And half a 30.
4 forward. 4 forward, drifting to the right a little.
30. 30 seconds.
2.5.
30 seconds.
Forward, just. Good. Okay. Contact light. Okay, engine stop. APA out of descent. Both control, both auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We've had shut down.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Okay, everybody, T1, stand by for T1.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Until next week, when we have another great program planned for you, this is Bruce Ash wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon.